Rise to Offend, a podcast that explores people who rose to offend in society and their legacy today. I'm your host, Petr Spych, and this week we are doing part one of two on dance marathons. The Depression-era endurance competition that was a major craze in America, and a radio contest that had couples dancing almost nonstop for hundreds of hours, with most contestants winning after about a month or two of dancing with no reprieve. The competitors would participate for prize money and a meal as a quarter of the country was out of work, and people would tune into radio stations for the entertainment value, spawning the first form of reality-based entertainment. The year is 1923, and setting world records were a huge importance to culture due to the modern Olympic Games, and feats of great human strengths and endurance were being tested daily in American culture to get the news headlines and put into the history books.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to have you meet one of the original couples here in the White City Ballroom Marathon in Chicago that started on August the 30th of last year, Frankie Wagner and Buddy Plarsky. How do you feel, Frankie?
Oh, I feel pretty tired. And after going about 5 months, we all feel tired, but we hope to win. We ain't gonna walk off this club until they pull us off.
Well, how's Betty?
Oh, Betty, she's asleep, but I'll wake her up and say a few words. Betty! Betty! Wake up!
Oh. Hey, what month is this?
Oh, I guess it's January, about 26th.
Oh, gee. Well,
you feeling tired?
How's your hot puppies today?
Oh, they feel like hot dogs.
Well, you think we can stick it out, Frankie?
Oh, you betcha. We're going to anyway, till the end.
Well, I hope so anyway. Gee, it's getting tougher every day. I want this darn thing to end.
And joining me this week, Brandon Guchon and Jocelyn Sharp. The cultural mindset of competition on a global scale started with the birth of the Olympic Games in 1896 in Athens, Greece. The event would only have 14 countries participate, with 241 athletes competing in 43 events. The first game would be successful, and the event, which in modern times would be seen as the Summer Olympic Games, would plant the seed for records being set.
When the BBC began to broadcast athletics, they chose Abrahams as their resident expert. That dry, analytical mind proved invaluable to the coverage.
He was really brilliant at this. It was his life's work. He would have a board in front of him, and on the board would have little slots for his watches. He'd always have one, two, possibly even three watches. He'd have a red pencil for world record, and a green pencil for something else, and so on. Incredible, and he managed to do all these things while still talking about a race.
His coolness became his trademark, but just occasionally that coolness would yield to the emotion of the moment.
The event would take place every 4 years in a bid to make it a global event. The locations would change in the 1900 Games in Paris and the 1904 Games in St. Louis, Missouri. The Games would have little interest or attendance, and although more nations would participate, the financial cost was too great and its events would not be profitable. By 1908, the Olympics started to try and expand the events to winter sports like ice hockey and figure skating, and this would revitalize the sports.
They called it the International Winter Sports Week, and it began on January 25th, 1924 in Chamonix, France, an alpine resort in the shadows of Mont Blanc, the highest European mountain peak west of Russia. 16 countries participated, bringing nearly 300 athletes, only 11 of which were women. They competed in five sports: ice hockey, curling, bobsled, skating, and Nordic skiing.
By 1921, the Olympic Games would officially try and split up the seasonal events, turn it into a summer and winter game with each season. And the sporting events would be seen as the globally recognized best athlete in the world, with new world records of strength and endurance being broken at each event.
The Scandinavians were dominant, led by Finnish speed skater Claes Thunberg, who earned 3 gold medals, a silver, and a bronze. The United States would only win 1 gold, thanks to Charles Jutras' performance in the 500-meter speed skating event. Meanwhile, the Canadians were no match for anybody in ice hockey, outscoring their opponents 122-3.
How do you think the Olympics changed the world and how we viewed being competitive?
Well, I feel like for us, competitiveness starts in elementary school, right? In our culture, it starts with sports. We've been a sports country for as long as football, baseball, that stuff's been alive. And when you're a kid, you know, it's interesting. That's one of the things you measure your social status on. Who can throw the ball the farthest? Who can run the fastest? All that stuff is kind of bred into us as humans. And so we already love competing with the people who live next door to us. But also to have the chance to know that you're the fastest in the world is like, that is some deep inner child accomplishment shit there. Like, I think that's like such a human want, is to know how good you are, to know that you're good enough, to know that you're good, especially in comparison to people in your country, but to know that how big the world is and to know that you can compete with people all over the world, that is such a different kind of accomplishment, I think.
That man next to me got a fly and there wasn't a recall. And I was a good yard and a half down in the first 10 and I kept my head. Really, I'm more pleased with that than winning, but I did come through and I won. And I knew jolly well I couldn't lose. I just found myself glorious feeling, just going a little bit faster than the others and through to the test there. But you see, no victory ceremony. I think some of these victory ceremonies are rather nice. I'm a bit regret that I didn't have that.
I think once you get a sporting event on a grand scale like that, and these athletes are also seeing the fruits of their labor. I mean, it's like, this is what happens when you're famous. You know, obviously you're getting flown to beautiful cities. You're getting expensive meals paid for free, you know, beautiful women. We're heading into the industrial, and the technology is going to start growing, and it's a lot easier to get the word out now. Keep in mind, maybe what, a few hundred years ago, the printing press was just made. Now we're on a much grander scale of information, and these people are soaking it in. And I just think that for the public, they're seeing exactly what happens when you are good, and when you succeed, you're going to be able to enjoy that.
I wanted something to justify myself. There was quite a deal of anti-Semitism at schools in those days. And I had to find something where I could score off people. And running, of course, you can do it. You can get first and you can win. And I was determined to do so.
In sporting events today, every talk show host is like, this is the GOAT. This is the greatest of all time. Muhammad Ali, Tom Brady, Michael Jordan. Back then,
it was none.
Back then, when you were the world record holder, there was no disputing it. You are the greatest of all time until the next person. Yes, but there wasn't a dispute. It was like single-handedly. You don't have 80, 90, 100 years of sports history. You're virtually on the cusp of this.
Exactly. And when you're talking about the greatest ever, it's like, what, the greatest ever? Well, the record was broken the following year. So it's like these records are constantly getting broken. So how can you sit there and be like, they're the greatest ever? Well, the record was just broken by another guy.
Well, for that year when it wasn't broken,
he's the greatest in the world.
But that's what I'm saying, because when you're not, because again, when you're talking about sports pundits, especially in today's day and age, we're talking about team sports. And when you're talking about team sports, it's so damn near impossible to say the GOAT, because somebody's teammates are helping them be
the
GOAT.
Well, and it's like there's generational differences. It's my husband and I's constant fight of Jordan versus LeBron, right? My husband and I are constantly having that fight. But I think that to Pete's point, when you talk about competitiveness on a world scale, there's something human in us that it's not negative necessarily. It sounds bad. It sounds like it's your bad wolf, but it's not. I think it's part of the things that make us successful. When you see how good someone can be, that can drive you to be your greatest. So that also is another part of it, is when you think you're the fastest man in the world, but then some guy comes from France and he's all of a sudden a lot faster than you. You're like, well, I better work a lot harder.
Yeah, it's Darwinism at its finest, and it's reminding people that you must be strong. I understand that you might not be an athlete, but you still need to be strong, especially in the 20s.
I think the last kind of carefree, silly generation is the 1920s. It was a reaction to the end of World War I. It was throwing off the Victorian era. Women got a right to vote. They drove cars. They had jobs. M's went up. Freud liberated people through sex, jazz, movies, goldfish eating, and pole sitting becomes kind of just another craze.
Culturally, the fad of setting world records would become a huge fad in American culture and entertainment. People who could not compete in athletic events would start to do endurance tests. And the most popularized endurance tests at this time would be flagpole sitting and cross-country foot races. What flagpole sitting is a seat would be placed on top of a flagpole, and people would try to break the world record of how long they can sit on the flagpole. And the last known record breaker for this was Bill Penfield from Strawberry Point, Iowa, who sat on a flagpole for 51 days and 20 hours until a thunderstorm knocked him off. Now, the majority of all the notoriety for record breakers...
I'm sorry, my brain played like a little skit in my head, of him getting knocked off by a thunderstorm.
Could you imagine him where he's just kind of like...
Well, and also the fact that he's like from Strawberry Fields, Iowa, my brain...
Strawberry Point, Iowa.
Oh, sorry, Strawberry Point. It sounds like he would be like, of course he's going to be... He's like, I just sure like sitting.
I just like sitting, and I like my peach cobbler.
I mean, I can sit for 51 days and get a $100 bill. Well, by golly.
I love how... I also want to know too, I can guarantee you the thunderstorm had to knock him off the flagpole. It wasn't him sitting on a metal flagpole in the middle of a thunderstorm. And some expert was like, you know what? It's probably not a good idea.
You should get down.
He's like, no, I know I can make it 52.
And what happened? Did the wind? Did the rain? I'm so fascinated. Anyway, sorry, sidebar.
Yeah. Everybody look it up. Ben Penfield, Strawberry Point, Iowa. The flagpole sitting record. Crushing it.
It was accessible. You could do it. Anybody could put a flagpole up and be a pole sitter. And most of these were kids, say, between the ages of 10 and 15. They would sit on a pole as long as possible to try to set the world record. Neighbors came out and watched. Even the mayor of Baltimore came and celebrated. So pole sitting was just a kind of weird reflection of a long tradition in American history that the average person could become a star.
Now, the majority of all this notoriety for record breakers and the Olympics was done through print broadcasting or at cinemas and newsreels before feature films. But by 1920, radio broadcasting became popularized throughout the world, and by 1924, it was now the new form of being on the pulse of the world, and it revolutionized life and the speed of information to the masses.
When the first patter of rain fell yesterday afternoon, Avon stood up and calmly announced to his manager, brother publicity agent, What? Had a publicity agent. We're 6 years old, 7 years old. He's got a publicity agent.
How do you feel, Dorothy?
Fine.
Do you remember how long you've been up there now?
18 days.
And how long do you intend to stay?
I'll stay to Christmas.
What did radio broadcasts do for the masses as a modern form of communication and technology in regards to the fad of breaking records and endurance tests?
It blew it up. It was informing the people that this is what's going on, and this is how you can get your name on the radio, and now everyone's going to know who you are. Again, it's just letting people know that it's the same thing with TikTok. It's the same thing with Instagram. It's like once you let the public know that there's a possibility that somebody like you, born in some hayseed town, you can make it a big time. All you got to do is sit on a flagpole for 51 days.
Well, and I think of how we come upon stand-up almost in this situation, the effect of radio. It's like, you don't really know what's possible until someone kind of shows you the hallway, right? It's like the same thing with stand-up. We grew up loving stand-up, never in a million years thinking we could figure out how to do it until somebody or something came along that showed us the hallway. Like, this is how you do it. So radio was this thing where all of a sudden, you know, you're a young man in Strawberry, whatever, Iowa. Iowa. And you hear on the radio that, you know, some man ran faster than any man's ever run. That's equivalent to a superhero. You know, and you want to be a superhero. It's the same thing as a little boy wanting to be Superman. It's what it's doing is when you have this mass communication, not only is it giving, first of all, the ability for people to break records quicker and make the competitiveness faster. Because if it takes 3 days for New York to find out somebody in LA broke the record, that's a whole different story. But now with the radio, I know the instant that record is broken. So now I'm going to go out and try and break the record again.
Mm-hmm.
It's that constant feeding of this. It's opening doors for people who didn't know they wanted to do those things, and then also pushing people who are already doing those things to be better.
In 1920, the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. The Federal Road Act of 1916 was the start of a significant period for American infrastructure. Over the following years, construction of roads was seen all across the nation. New industries like aviation, chemicals, and electronics arose, which provided both jobs and consumer products for the emerging American dream. Companies looked at the new technology and produced many devices such as vacuum cleaners, toasters, washing machines, and refrigerators. This enabled the average working American to achieve more time for leisure, and the economy prospered. The use of financial credit became widely accepted. However, the implications of debt were ignored in order to maintain the American standard of living. Prosperity in the 1920s wasn't equally spread. Americans celebrated big business, and Wall Street became a well-known location for trade, selling stocks and shares. However, with the rise in affluence throughout many areas of the economy, there were also extremes of social and economic hardship apparent in many other aspects of American life. It is estimated that 40% of Americans lived in poverty.
And on top of that, this is also a time where mankind just wasn't constantly being stimulated. So whenever you did go to the motion pictures, or whenever you did hear something on the radio, it was for real. Like, they took it for real. Granted, there wasn't another website. There wasn't another radio station trying to dispute this person's news. That was just the news. Well, it was books and plays and theater. That was it. I mean, as far as anything.
Vaudeville,
that was it.
Although there were many instrumental groups performing ragtime before him, player piano roles brought his music into homes all over the country. And the ragtime craze was on. This exciting new music was created simultaneously in many southern towns, but it really caught on in New Orleans. The lively seaport community provided more opportunity than other southern towns for interchange among people of different cultural backgrounds. Its less rigid social attitudes allowed jazz to flourish in saloons, dance halls, honky-tonks, and other places of entertainment, so that the Crescent City became the first true jazz center.
Common people becoming extraordinary were now commonplace. And fads, trends, and endurance tests would make common people celebrities and world-renowned for a few days. The need for fame would spark common people across the world, and the desire of the youth to reach this status would become vital.
In New Orleans, music was and still is at the core of the black community's social life. There was music for church, for such social events as picnics and dances, marching bands for all kinds of special events, for many everyday activities, and for weddings and funerals. Much of this music was ragtime, and out of this everyday need for music came some of history's most innovative jazz musicians. Many of them played on the riverboats that traveled from the great port city of New Orleans, spreading the music up and down the Mississippi. As musicians traveled around, jazz acquired its unique sound and developed its own standards of form, complexity, literacy, and excellence, and its own syntax.
Prohibition laws would come into play in America, which was banning alcohol sales across the country in the 1920s, and this would spark a musical revolution in the youth that was not seen in years prior. The music of the era was jazz, and the all-night dancing would be a part of the appeal of the scene. Sexuality was on display in the youth, and although very liberal, the movement of each dance partner would be on full display, and the appeal of finding a dance partner was an edgy change to modern society during the jazz musical revolution.
In the 1920s, prohibition was fully enacted. It was ratified by the 18th Amendment and officially began in 1920, making the production and sale of alcohol illegal. Prohibition was very difficult to enforce. There were very few prohibition agents, who were often easily bribed to ignore the offences. Bootleggers manufactured and exported alcohol, making homemade moonshine, and smuggled them into cities. With the enactment of prohibition, speakeasies began to pop up. These were secretive places where alcohol was consumed and sold, and they were often run by organised crime groups. Al Capone battled for the control of the bootlegging and speakeasy trade. This resulted in gang violence as opposing gangs sought to profit from prohibition.
What did the dance halls and jazz music do to the youth in the conservative alcohol-free times of America?
Well, it's so funny because of jazz cigarettes. I was interestingly just thinking that you said that, the jazz clubs. I was thinking the parallel of our 90s, right? We went through that phase in the 90s where things like Jackass and intense entertainment was popular, incredibly violent entertainment. And I've watched over the years as more marijuana has become more and more legal, as they've, you know, lessened prohibition of some things that are less harmful of you. That now the entertainment is like makeover shows and cooking shows. It's like humans are humans and they need certain pressure release valves. Drugs can be that, entertainment can be that. At this point in time, the youth, the jazz clubs were a pressure release valve. There was parents at home who were alcoholics who were now beating the shit out of them every night because they were detoxing. Like, you know, that this was a hard time for people, and people's parents who made money off of, you know, working in speakeasies or brewing, I mean, their lives were in danger every single day. They never knew when something was going to happen. Their bathtubs were full of booze. I mean, it was hard. So I would be out at a jazz club dancing with some boy, too.
Here we are dancing 24 hours daily at White City, Chicago, in the world's greatest marathon. It originally started here at the White City Ballroom with 126 couples on August the 30th of last year. These dancers are on the floor constantly, 24 hours a day, taking 10-minute rest periods. They are finding considerable difficulty keeping their feet in shape, but they're still going, not very strong, but nevertheless still going. And that's the main thing in a marathon contest.
Jazz was the exact opposite of the conservative alcohol times, and the youth just flood to the opposite of what society is kind of doing. You know, the youth are going to want to go where their parents are afraid to go. And at that time, jazz was the hip hop. Jazz was the heavy metal music.
The birth of jazz is often accredited to Black Americans, but it was soon adopted by America's white middle class. Jazz became characterized by a meshing of African American traditions and the ideals of the white middle class society. Jazz became extremely popular in cities such as New York, Chicago, and New Orleans, and they quickly became central hubs for the movement. New York specifically with the Harlem Renaissance. Dances developed during the Jazz Age include the Charleston, the Cakewalk, the Black Bottom, and the Flea Hop. Most of these were developed by the African American community, and they instantly became very popular.
The patient zero of the endurance competition that would spawn the American craze called dance marathons would be a woman by the name of Alma Cummings. Alma was a New York dance instructor and would waltz for 27 straight hours, exhausting many male dance partners along the way, and would set the record. She would perform and create this record in an Upper Manhattan ballroom in New York, and the world was fascinated. Someone can endure 27 straight hours of ballroom dancing, and a woman would outlast the male partners. Alma's record would not last long, for as soon as it was announced, her record would be broken, and reportedly 9 times across the United States.
Dance marathons was an American phenomenon of the 1920s and 1930s. These marathons were human endurance contests in which couples danced almost nonstop for hundreds of hours, competing for prize money. The craze began in 1923 when 32-year-old Alma Cummings danced nonstop for 27 hours, wearing out 6 different partners, breaking the previous record set in Britain.
Now, during the early 1920s, the industrial boom was also occurring for the working class, and the routine and lifestyle for Americans was changing. Entertainment was sought after. A long, hard day's work and the radio was replacing outdoor activities for many. Promoters quickly came to terms that dance marathons would be a sellable endurance test and would start to be marketed easily to the masses.
Marathon dancing had been around since the early 20s. Back then, it was part of the craze to establish endurance records. At first, dancers moved non-stop to recorded music for more than 24 hours at a time. But promoters soon found a way of extending the contests indefinitely by changing the rules.
Why do you feel the dance marathon craze became easily marketed to the masses as a form of entertainment in the mid-1920s?
Well, number one, as always, the youth drives capitalism. Anyone between the ages of 16 and 30 is really who's spending their money in popular culture out doing things. Outside of that, it's mortgages and, you know, responsible shit, right? So as a kid, you're dancing all night long, right? So this is a feasible competition for me, because when you're young, you're like, you think you can do anything when you're young, right? You're like, I can jump out of a plane, I can run a mile, I can do all that shit. And it's like, when you're young, you know that you spent the last Friday dancing for 7 hours with Joe Schmo at the dance club, and then you hear that you can win a lot of money if you dance for 27. Like, that is why it caught like wildfires, because you hear that on the radio when you're already dancing every Friday and Saturday. It's something you love doing. Somebody's doing it better than you. Also, they're doing it great, which, even if you aren't competitive, you are going to be interested in seeing somebody do something that's that remarkable.
New dance styles also emerged. The Charleston and the tango became very popular with young Americans. Many young women became flappers. They rebelled from the restrictive fashions of corsets in favor of short hair and short skirts. These women were seen to smoke, drink, wear makeup, play tennis, and socially they danced wildly at jazz clubs. Many Americans watched American football, baseball, basketball, boxing, and other sports, and were spurred on by the popularity of the radio. Sport was becoming a recreational activity. By 1920, most households owned a radio, giving the population greater access to sports, music, and obviously information from news programs. Radios made information more accessible, and advertisers were keen to promote their products through these means.
People love watching reality television, and they just love watching other people do stuff that they can do. There is a show called How It's Made, where they show people, you know, they show like a factory or something like that. And they just show regular, you know, $14 an hour guys just doing all these jobs. And you get fascinated because it's like, oh, wow, that's how it's made. You're watching some guy just do a job that anybody could do, but you're like, oh, wow, you know, and you are drawn to that. And anytime that you see people just doing something you can do, like, again, you'll see people gravitate towards an art form that they could do. A lot of people don't even bother with guitar because it's so fucking hard, but I'll go do hip hop because I know I can rhyme. I know I can get into that. And once you can see yourself doing it, it becomes, you know, you're way more interested in it.
But also remember at the time, the greatest thing you had seen was Joe from down the street had climbed up a tree in less than a minute, you know? So hearing that a woman dance for 27 hours straight is the equivalent of that time we heard a guy walked across a wire between, you know, the Twin Towers. Yeah. It's the same. It's the scale is the same. It was the same shock level. So at that time it was like, it was like getting to watch the moon landing, you know, totally different perspective.
And from a broadcasting perspective, they can make an underdog story. They can sell the people that should win. They can sell so many with just the characters that are coming in there. Be like, you're going to be this. You're going to be that. You're going to be this. And they can fabricate it and let it be sold as it was.
And so they're still doing it. And they're still that same exact
100 years later. Reality TV is
that same theory. Yeah.
During the Depression, marathon dancing took on a whole new character. It became hugely popular. People looking for cheap entertainment found it at the dance halls. 25 cents to get in, a dollar a night, and you could stay for hours. It became far more than an endurance contest. Marathon dances evolved into live soap operas, heated dramas of romance, survival, and danger, and full of gimmicks to keep the customers coming back. The most popular promotion was a wedding staged on the dance floor. The lucky couples were thrown lavish ceremonies complete with, in this case, cellophane gowns. Some of these weddings were legitimate, but by no means all.
The beginning of the dance marathon crazes was a fun event and time, mostly done on college campuses across the country. Promoters would make huge profits selling the contestants' backstories, mostly fabricated, and actually selling tickets to the event. The live event tickets would allow spectators to buy one ticket and watch the event live from start to finish. Giving the live audience an endurance test as well, promoters and contestants quickly put together two things. The longer the event took place, the more money they would make because how invested the audience was to the contestants, and the longer the contestant was on the radio broadcast, their 15 minutes of fame would last.
Yowza, yowza, yowza.
Welcome to the Dance of Destiny, ladies and gentlemen. Around and around and around we go, and we're only beginning, folks. Only beginning. On and on and on. And when will it stop? When will it end? When? Only when the last two of these wonderful, starry-eyed kids are left. Only when the last two dancers stagger and sway, stumble and swoon across the sea of defeat and despair to victory. One couple and only one will waltz out of here over broken bodies and broken dreams, carrying the grand prize of $1,500 silver dollars. Mr. Lightman, the clock of fate, ladies and gentlemen. I said the prize, because only one couple will dance on to fame and fortune. Those who give up, those who give out, those who give in, out! Tough rules, but these are tough times.
What does the mixture of fame and money create for contestants and promoters in an endurance competition?
It's amazing what you can do when you have the right motivators, right? When we think of through history and there's all those famous stories, the mom who lifted the car off her kid, all those things that the human body is capable of when you really are motivated. Like there's things that your body can do that you don't realize it can do. American snipers sleep for 3 hours every week. And you know, when they're on post, like it's insane what the body can do. So you're standing there dancing. You think you're going to collapse, but then you see a pile of $5 bills, $1 bills. That's a heavy motivator. Think about the fact that what money they're winning is what their dad works to the bone, to his knuckle in a day for. He works 12-hour days on a skyscraper or some shit to make the same amount of money they can make if they can just hold out for one more hour.
It would be like a $1,000 prize.
It's a powerful motivator.
Yeah, on some of these contests. That $1,000 in the 20s.
3 months of living expenses at least?
Probably more.
Yeah. Oh, probably a whole year.
Yeah.
Gertrude Utterly swam the English Channel. There were tree sitters, people who sat in trees. There were flagpole sitters. Some man pushed a peanut up Pike's Peak with his nose. I mean, people were trying to express, you know, what is the limit of the human body as a machine.
First off, when you combine fame and money, it's automatically going to grab people's attention. And then you're talking about these dance competitions. Nobody really knew what they were yet. So as we go on, I mean, this is so new to that everybody's like, oh yeah, I could do that. That's no problem. You know, 27 hours. Well, I danced for 4 hours with Fred last night and I went home with a big smile on my face and I woke up and I'm right as rain. Everything's fine. Some people might think that they could stay in that euphoric state of mind that dancing can bring them for an extended period of time, especially when you got that dollar bill sitting across the other end of the hallway and you're watching that and you're like, oh, I want it.
And they feed you 7 times a day on a table that rolls out on the floor. So you can eat 7 times. I thought, gee, they feed you. That was pretty good.
Look, again, it's all TikTok from the 20s. It's people that are just trying to get out in front of everybody just so they could seem like a big deal. That's what this is.
Well, when you think about the promoters too, that's also, you know, what the fame and money did is it means that if I'm a promoter, I'm not going to go out and just pick any Joe Schmo to be in my dance competition. I'm going to look for people who are going to make it last the longest, make me the most money. I mean, it just really created a powerful new industry for a lot of people. And since it was one of the only forms of live entertainment that was outside of all the other shit they had been used to for the past 50 years.
In modern times, though, just like anything, any big money, say corporation or whatever like that, hey, I'm going to hire you on this job and this is what I'm expected from you. Those expectations double, triple even, because now you need the job and you have to do that. That is the same mindset. This is, all right, well, I'm expecting you to dance for 27 hours. All right, let's take it to 200 because I'm making more money and you can win that money. You see what I'm saying? The endurance, when it is an endurance thing, you can take advantage of it because they're already halfway in. I've danced for 100 hours. I can't quit now. We're going to keep going. We're going to keep making money. And that's where it is that they're caught in a almost like a, like a rat race where it's like, I can't quit because I'm this invested.
Well, you're on a hamster wheel too. And, yeah. And especially if you're a woman at this time, because there was not many chances for women to make large amounts of money like this. There was not very many chances.
By the Depression, those rules were generally 45 minutes of dancing and 15 minutes of rest, 24 hours a day, round the clock. One contestant, Stan West, told me that he loved to seduce women in the audience and that he would try to get them to go outside with him for 15 minutes during his rest break instead of going to the boys' quarters. Fortunately or unfortunately, it was a very quick event.
Now, fame and fortune, although there were cash prizes for the events, were hard to maintain or capture for dance marathons. But attention was guaranteed, and the promoters knew that was a selling point and motivation for the young contestants. Money was a huge motivator for middle-aged contestants at the time that were in trouble of losing their farm or struggling to make ends meet, but the youth would always be the promoter's selling point.
Popular couples would find local sponsors. Audience members would throw coins at their favorite dancers. This was called a silver shower.
Well, it's money. You put it in the pocket, you put it in the drawer in the back, and by the time you leave, you got $100 in change.
And of course, there was the prize money, $1,000 or more, that awaited the last couple on their feet.
Now, the rules were somewhat different for every contest and would be spelled out on pamphlets to the event, but here are the standard rules for most dance marathons in the mid-1920s. Dancers had to remain in motion during the contest at all times. 15-minute breaks would occur every hour, and nurses would be set up to rub the contestants' feet during those breaks. The contestants would get food many times throughout the day. However, routine day-to-day things such as bathing, shaving, reading a paper would be done while dancing. Sleep would also occur during dancing. The contestants had to stay up on their partner and keep moving as they would sleep on each other in motion. The only requirement is nobody's knees were allowed to touch the ground, or you would be eliminated.
Will she make it? Will she make it? After over 1,100 hours of incredible endurance, there she is, alone, but still fighting, still hoping, still trusting, Gloria Beatty. 17 hours, that's all she has left. Will she find a new partner before those hours run out? Will fortune reward her pluck and spirit? Will she make it?
How long do you think people can maintain that endurance of a dance marathon with those rules and conditions?
I mean, if you're sleeping in your partner's arms and you're being fed, you can go way longer than you possibly. Again, if you're that desperate, you'll push your body to the absolute limit. We've seen it happen 100 times. We've seen it happen in 100 different kind of endurance competitions. Once that goal is in front of you, you're going to go until you get it. And when you see videos of these dance competitions, again, I mean, it's like people are fucking just falling down.
Well,
like they're totally standing and then just,
it's dead weight in someone's arms.
Yeah.
I mean, dead weight. It's crazy. And you see these little kind of like these like 5'5" girls holding up these guys who are like 6'5" just over their shoulder. And like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And they're just keeping those legs up, sleeping on them for, let's just say, 45 straight minutes.
I think the line between what was performed and what was in fact really going on was often very blurry.
It's kind of crazy because if you have a 15-minute break every hour, you can kind of do anything. I was kind of interested to hear that there were breaks because, again, I will keep going back to the fact that there's so many. I was really into like extremes and Ripley's Believe It or Not when I was a kid. I was one of those Guinness World Records Ripley's Believe It or Not book kids that brought it to school. Like, I was really into that stuff. And the human body is capable of some really insane things. Like, if you really focus, and we really only know a short amount of what the human body is capable of. But this is also a time in our country where there's not a lot of public health programs, not a lot of public assistance programs. This is before the New Deal. This is before all that shit, right? So think about the fact that there is so few ways to get help if you're in a dire situation. And there was a lot more people in dire situations then than there are today. There's a lot of people poor, a lot of people hungry today. I'm not saying there's not. I'm just saying when you were poor and hungry in 1918, 1919, that was a way different situation.
You can starve to death in America.
You could starve to death in America.
Yeah. Polite society was scandalized by dance marathons, suspecting that the prizes were rigged, as they often were, and that more than resting was going on during the breaks, as it often was. Unfazed, the fans kept on coming back to the dance halls. They became a haven for out-of-work entertainers. Red Skelton was an MC for a time when vaudeville dried up. Jazz diva Anita O'Day performed for the first time at a marathon.
And I just said, I know a tune called The Lady in Red. Do you think I could sing it some night, you know? And they let me sing The Lady in Red. And the people in the audience throw money on the floor. Everybody helps pick it up to put it in your pocket, take it in the back room, put it in your suitcase, and you're beginning to save your money. You're beginning to learn to sing with the band.
By 1928, the dance marathon world would have stars and repeat contestants like Halem de Villair, who would repeatedly win contests lasting 443 hours at certain events, which is 18 straight days. As the dance craze continued and the endurances went longer and longer, the events were starting to take notice on how far they would go and the length the contestants were putting themselves through.
My mother gambled on the stock market, so she always asked me to call up Saint-Phal, which was the broker, and ask them for the quotation, the stock market quotations. So I called again that one afternoon. And I didn't remember from one day to the next what the quotations were. And I quoted the figures to her, and she faded dead away on the bed.
And then, on October 24th, 1929, the stock market would crash, and the onset of the American Great Depression would seize the country, and desperation would sweep across the nation.
The demand for goods vanished. Assembly lines ground to a halt. And crops rotted in the field because they weren't worth the price of picking. In response to the emergency, President Hoover cut income taxes. It was little help when the tax on an average salary of $4,000 was less than $6 per year. But otherwise, he believed government should leave the economy alone. It would heal itself. Prosperity, he predicted, was just around the corner. That kind of advice had seen Americans through recessions for more than 100 years. But this time, they weren't buying it. Americans turned on the president with a vengeance.
What effect do you think the Great Depression would have on a craze like dance marathons?
Just going to create a lot more desperation. And when you're desperate and you're hungry and your kids are hungry, you're going to go for months. And you're going to join these competitions and you're going to sell out completely because you're not going to go on there as Petr Spych. You're going to go on there as Crazy Legs Pete. That would be your nickname or something like that. And they would give you some fake persona and you'd have to go out there and play that fake persona. And you're going to do it. Rock and roll, that backlash, that what rock and roll really is, that is such a far cry from what's going on right now.
Well, and here's the thing is when people get desperate, the people in charge can offer them a lot less. So this is going to become a very different situation because when you are in charge of desperate people, you can take advantage of them in a way that you can't take advantage of people who aren't desperate.
And even, but you got to understand though, the people that were even behind the contest, they were losing money. They were like, the prize money definitely went down because they just didn't have it. Now, granted, they were definitely taking advantage of these people. They were definitely exploiting these people. But back in those days, you didn't have a journalist that was exposing people. I mean, who knows how many people were physically
hurt.
No, OSHA. Yeah, they're not showing these people that were like exhausted and just flat out, just just dead weight on the ground because of dehydration, exhaustion, whatever. They're not putting that out there. They're only going to go out there and talk about the winner, the one who made it, the one with the money. They're not going to talk about all the other people that suffered. And if that kind of thing happened in this day and age, the other side would get exposed.
Look, sweetheart, I've been in this business a long time. I may not know a winner when I see one, but I sure as hell can spot a loser.
You son of a bitch.
Maybe. Do you want to come out of this with a couple $100 or don't you?
The winners get $750 apiece.
Right. Less the bills.
What bills?
Look, this marathon don't run itself, you know. I got bills stacked up every day. And I keep tabs. It just costs me money. Extra laundry, cleaning, phone calls, medical bills, you name it.
What is this?
It's the tabs and you and Robert.
You're charging me this?
Only if you win. If you don't win, you don't pay. I'm not out to cheat anybody.
You got to realize, though, these people couldn't feed themselves. They would die of starvation. They were homeless. They were in trouble. So it's like, to go to a dance marathon, it's like, obviously, insanity, and you're putting yourself through hell, but you're going to survive for a longer period of time than if you're on the street.
I mean, it's the same thing as the Thunderdome, you know? It's just like...
It seems that way.
Yeah, and just like we were talking about...
Mad Max, right?
Yeah.
And here's the thing, and the sad part about it is those competitions would feed people. Pete's talking about people being hungry. That's how they would eat. They'd have to be up on their feet for 18 fucking hours, but at least they got three solid meals every day.
Yeah.
And they had a roof over their head. There was cots where the nurses would come and rub their feet, but they can crash on that cot for 15 minutes, breaks, and then pop back up and go do that thing. But they'd get fed, and they would have, you know, shelter from the cold. Say this is happening in Minnesota, where a lot of these did happen. Milwaukee, hey, it's the winter. I got to go do a dance competition right now, and I can survive this winter, or I'm dead. That's really what the marketing was based on.
Welcome to my kitchen. I'm Claire. I'm 93 years old. And today we are making meals from the Depression.
This morning we're making the Depression breakfast.
The first thing we're going to make is the sugar cookies.
Measure out 3/4 cup of sugar.
Breakfast. We had bread and butter and coffee. We used to dip our bread in the coffee and eat it. Thought that was great. But on Sundays we'd have cookies, which was a big treat. We didn't have cookies until Sunday.
Now, many groups and politicians came after dance marathons at this time. Movie theater owners attacked the craze because the events were so long that people would stop paying money to go watch the films instead. Church groups saw the event socially unacceptable, meaning that people are holding each other for too long, and women's groups would deem them unethical and designed to watch desperate people humiliate themselves. But the majority of the contestants after the Great Depression would participate because they needed the prize money to survive. They would get food during the competition, and a vast majority were homeless. The desperation that came into these events would now prolong them to insane lengths because it was shelter, food, and hope for its contestants.
It was reported that dance marathons were directly and indirectly responsible for numerous deaths, although no figures on the amount were reported.
Are these events preying on desperate times, or is this bit of shelter, food, and hope a valid opportunity that the radio stations are giving people?
I think that preying on desperate times and valid opportunities is a thin line. I think that you can prey on desperate times and give people great opportunities. And I think this was, everybody suffered during this time. Nobody was in a great place. I mean, we just similarly went through this as a world. You know, we were all went through the pandemic together. Same thing during the Great Depression. This entire country was in the same boat. So do I think that they were taking advantage? I'm sure if you're trying to survive and your kids are hungry, you're going to dance the same way you're like, well, I can get 30 people to dance and I can feed my family for a week. You know, that's the same energy. So I don't think that they're mutually exclusive.
I remember looking with considerable interest at one room in a Chicago club where members took stocks that went to nothing and pasted them on the wall as a souvenir of the Depression.
I think that with the radio station, again, back in those days, there was such a thin line between the haves and the have-nots. And when the haves, meaning the people that were putting on the competition, I mean, yeah, they may have had a house, but they sure in the hell weren't taking home a lot of money. I mean, they were one step away from being on Skid Row and being in these competitions themselves. So I just think that at that moment where everybody's scrambling to survive, human decency is going to take a back seat. And it doesn't matter how many people get hurt at these competitions. It doesn't matter how many people get embarrassed, or like the women were saying, that doesn't matter. It's bedlam right now. It's Mad Max. We got to find shelter. We need the basic human necessities. And again, living in America in 2021, not having the basic human necessities, bitching because I don't get cell phone service in Iowa. That's the type of things we're bitching about. Back in those days, real shit. Things you needed to survive were at a shortage. And you're seeing exactly what people were doing to take the public's mind off of that misery, which is what the competitions, which is what entertainment was. but you're also seeing the people. You can't not see it. So I mean, anywhere you turn, you're going to be able to see somebody struggling, somebody just living in impoverished conditions. This is giving people a chance to put their attention towards something else. So even though there were people that were hurting, it was helping out the nation as well, because it's at least giving them something to take their mind off of all the horrendous conditions that they're living through every single day. And they're going to be doing it for years.
I'd like to be serious for a moment, folks, if you'll permit me. Harry Klein is one of those brave young men who sailed off to beat the Kaiser. That's right, a veteran of the Great War. And let's hope there'll never be another. Harry was decorated in that war for wounds received in action. But that's not all. I know Harry wouldn't want me to tell you this, but right now, at this moment, there are 32 separate pieces of shrapnel still embedded in Harry's body. 32! And here he is fighting another kind of war and fighting to win. Isn't that the kind of grit and never-say-die spirit that's made this a great country it is, isn't it? You bet it is. And I really mean that sincerely, folks, from the bottom of my heart.
Humans have thrived a lot, especially in first world countries like America, Europe, things like that. Humans were thriving for many, many years and have been in and out of thriving, the Renaissance, all of these things, many eras of cultures and cities and states and countries that were thriving, and humans were really in a great place. But what is truth across eons of history is when you take a human's ability to survive and you threaten it, it changes the dynamic of how they're willing to interact with their environment. Meaning, I may not be the type of person who's willing to kill another human being until my life is in threat. Like, think about the Donner Party, for instance. The Donner Party, when it came down to survival, were eating their family members. And there's reports that while they cried, it was half tears of joy, half tears of sadness. They were so happy to have a meal and so sad to eat their family. When it comes to survival, the rules change.
Yeah, fathers and mothers that were homeless would see their kids die in the cold. There was reports of fathers killing their whole family, and it's not investigated. It's like a mercy killing because of what the world or what America was going through these days. So these dance competitions in that that hopelessness that everybody was seeing for years, not just like, oh, this was 1 year. No, for years. It was something, like I said, it was entertainment for the certain people, but for a lot of people, it was like the last chance before, hey, it's over. I'm just going to go down like all the kids I went to high school with that are dying in the streets that didn't have any money, and all the families that I saw go away. It's over. There was bodies of dead
in the street,
people in the street.
It was a form if, I mean, maybe I'm using the wrong term here, but it kind of reminded me of the Roman Colosseum. I mean, those gladiators weren't upper echelon members of society. I mean, they were poor. They were dragged off the street. Maybe they were
criminals.
They were criminals. Yeah. Maybe they were part of the losing team on a war. You know, I mean, they were
prisoners. Yes.
But again, these were all guys that came from bleak surroundings, and the crowd didn't give a shit. And the leaders knew that the crowd needed to be entertained, and they knew the crowd just needed to have this escape, or else everything is going to be crumbling around them even more than it already is.
This is this human inability for us to admit that everyone has Schadenfreude, right? We all take comfort in seeing someone do worse than us, not in an inhumane way, in a way that, oh, thank God it's not that bad.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God I'm not there. I'm not that. It's this human need to know that you are at least succeeding above someone else. As sick as it is human. It is a survival mechanism where your brain is going, where do you sit? Is there a bigger dog in the yard? Is it a threat? Like, that's the way it is.
So it gives you a chance to breathe.
And the entertainment of it, it's the ability to release yourself. It's why we like reality TV. It's why we like My 600-Pound Life. It's because we get to watch people who are so actively the opposite of how we live our lives that we can sit in self-righteous comfort that we're doing the right thing, that it's going to be okay. It's this Band-Aid.
Everywhere you go, everyone you meet, all they talk about is this depression. They blame it on the war, they blame it on Wall Street, on politics and this administration. For 2 years now we've been assured good times are on the way. I wonder how much longer we must hear them talk this way.
Prosperity is just around the corner.
What we'd like to know is which corner. We've turned so many corners now we're dizzy.
But still I'm positive we'll soon be busy. Why, I read in Monday's paper where 10,000 men were hired.
Yes, but Tuesday they forgot to say 12,000 more were fired.
But I insist this land of ours is stable.
Stable? Sounds like horses to me.
As the Great Depression marched on through America, prohibition laws still in full effect, the rise of gangster culture and corruption would follow, and those not inclined to turn to a life of crime would have entertainment as the distraction. They had a roof over their head and electricity, but the price and cost to the participating would start to have permanent results for the contestants.
Tell him to turn up the Victrola.
Oh, please help!
That won't help her now. Cheryl?
They're crawling on me!
Listen to me, Cheryl. Listen to me.
They're crawling on me!
Where are they? Tell me. Tell me where they are. Here. In your arm. Your arm. Here. In your shoulder. There. They're all gone.
Quite a technique. I would have thought you'd put her on display, charge a little extra.
No, it's too real.
Follow my co-host Brandon Hahn on Twitter and Instagram at Your Buddy Gooch. Jocelyn Sharp on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jocelyn Sharp, and also on TikTok at The Wizard of Jaws. Sylvia Alvarado on Twitter and Instagram at It's the Sylvia, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Rise to Offend, and on Instagram at Rise to Offend Official. And make sure to listen to us every Monday on the Metal Sucks podcast on metalsucks.net. Email us comments, questions, errors we may have made, or any figure you would like us to cover, risetooffend@gmail.com. Invest the time to learn of the craze known as dance marathons in America during the Great Depression. Read the book by Carol Martin, Theater of the Real and Dance Marathons, Performing American Culture of the 1920s and 1930s, and watch the 1969 feature film starring Jane Fonda, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? All content on this show is copyrighted by its owners. Thank you all so much for the reviews on iTunes. These 5-star reviews are helping this show grow, and is all we can ask from you guys. Please, if you listen to the show and appreciate all the hard effort behind it, review the show on iTunes for us. It truly means the world that you take the time to listen and to review the show. Next week, we will do part 2 of 2 on dance marathons. Until next week, repeat offenders. RTO Podcast, signing off.